radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to firehouse.com.
Well, welcome to Training and Tactics Talk on RadioFirehouse.com. I'm Douglas Klein, your host. And Training and Tactics Talk is focused on providing today's training and tactics for firefighters and fire officers on the streets. We're committed to making sure that we have current and up-to-date information so that we're enhancing our firefighters' knowledge and their skills, and we want to make sure that we're keeping them safe and that everyone goes home. I want to welcome our listeners to the show, and we're excited about a topic that most people don't get excited about, and that's carbon monoxide responses, which can be critical responses. As you will find out going through this program, we're going to share some information with you that should open your eyes when you're responding to these type of calls. Joining me today on the show, I'm excited to have a gentleman who has received several awards in his efforts for fire and life safety education. He's got 23 years in the business, serving both career and volunteer fire service. It's Daniel Bernardi. He serves as the training officer of Invern Grove Heights, Minnesota. And just to give you a little background on his efforts with fire and life safety education, he's a former Minnesota Deputy State Fire Marshal. He received the Minnesota Firefighter of the Year Award in 1996, and he's received a prestigious award from the Congressional Fire Service Institute, and that's focused towards fire and life safety education. And I was there at the Congressional Fire Service Dinner when Daniel received that award, and that's a really prestigious award, and that's dedicated to his efforts and what he's done for the fire service. Excited to have a gentleman like that on board and a great professional in the fire service. So welcome, Daniel. It's great to have you, and I'm excited. And we're going to talk about cold weather responses a little bit, but we're going to focus in on what is known as a silent killer of many people. And we're going to see some of these statistics that I have in front of me, and we're going to talk about carbon monoxide responses.
Well, thanks for having me, Mr. Klein. And, the timing couldn't be any better. We're facing our first of the cold weather snaps here in Minnesota as we speak.
Well, and I understand that you had pretty much a blizzard last night. Our producer, who's on recording right down the street from him just minutes ago, was a working job. They had a structure fire that was in a back bedroom. We weren't sure if we were going to be producing the show at this current time, whether he was going to be evacuated or not. So we see that wintertime brings a lot of different style responses, and it typically increases our number of structure fires. And we're definitely going to this animal called carbon monoxide. And just to kind of refresh folks, and I'm sure everybody knows what carbon monoxide is, being colorless, odorless, extremely poisonous, and an explosive gas that causes about 1,500 accidental deaths or more a year, and about 10,000 injuries each year. It's, lighter than air. It mixes in the atmosphere. It's a byproduct of incomplete combustion. It comes from fuels such as natural gas, propane, or heating oils, coal, gasoline, wood, when it's not getting good combustion, and that's due to insufficient air. So what are some of these problems we run into, Dan? What do you think about when the tones go off from your perspective, from being a firefighter for all these years in fire and life safety education, when the tones drop and we have companies running the carbon monoxide alarms?
Well, one of my main concerns is that people aren't going to respond initially to the alarm themselves and take it as a serious effort. I've been on many calls where the family said, well, it's been going off for a couple of days and we can't seem to get it to stop, or they have had a alarm that was a couple of years old, so they dismissed it for that reason. Our main problem with this response is the people themselves, the victims, not taking their alarm seriously. And so we coach them on that when we come there. We've had a half a dozen carbon monoxide alarms over the last week, and during that period we We see that these individuals are now, it's getting colder, so they don't want to go outside. They don't want to go into their garage, get their vehicle. But that's what we recommend is get your vehicle, if you can, back out of the garage, park in the street, and stay warm until we can respond. Keep all the windows and doors closed so that we can get some good readings. But getting that information to the public is a difficult thing, and we've done a good job of that. We have done a training session on cable television. We have a cable access, government access cable show, and so we've given some direction in that way, and we see that kind of thing works. But a lot of them, just like I say, they don't smell it, they don't see it, they don't feel sick, so they're kind of dismissing them.
And, you know, that's an issue. But here's the other side of the fence. I'm going to jump to the responder side. How many times do you see our emergency folks, our responders, our personnel that are responding to these calls with a very complacent attitude? Oh, it's just another routine alarm. There's nothing to this.
Yes, that's true too. And but we keep we have had a couple of incidents that keep our firefighters a little more attuned to it. We've had a individual last fall. Well, it must have been about 14 months ago now, that these people set their furnace or their thermostat on in the morning. It was an October day. It was a little cool. Most people didn't have their furnaces on yet. And this woman got up at 6 a.m. for work, and she turned her thermostat on because she wanted it to warm up in the house while she was in the shower. She wasn't in the shower 5 minutes, and this carbon monoxide alarm was going off. She did the right thing after a few minutes of looking around to find out what was making the noise, and she couldn't figure out what alarm was going off. She swatted one of the smoke alarms off of the ceiling with a broom and had her son look at another smoke alarm, and they concluded that it wasn't that. And they got outside, and we got there, and it was less than 10 minutes from the time that the original alarm went off in her house when we came in the door, and there was 800 parts per million in the house already. So with our firefighters having witnessed that, now we're much more in tune with taking these things for real.
And that's something that our firefighters, our responders across, you know, the world need to be thinking about. You know, these aren't routine alarms. Just because we drop the tones and it says alarm, we somewhat tend to go into that complacent mode. But at any given time, we know that this can happen. And that's a prime example. So,
and
just
to kind of cover,
go ahead, Dan.
Well, and this type of complacency we face in just about every area of response. But carbon monoxide alarms had their debut about 15 years ago and caused us a whole lot of trouble with people just saying, "Oh, this is just a typical alarm, and it's a waste of our time, and shouldn't the energy company be taking care of this, and so on." But when you see things that close, and I don't want people to have to see it, go with our experience and the experience of others out there. Don't wait until you've had one of your own. But we have to take every alarm, whether it's the same place we've been five times before or whether it's the same type of alarm. We need to respond. We're paid by our communities, and we're expected by our citizens to treat them all equally, and we need to do that.
You're exactly right. And just to talk about the effects of CO, when we have a person that breathes in carbon monoxide, it's absorbed by the hemoglobin, and the hemoglobin is the oxygen-carrying protein in the blood. And
correct.
The hemoglobin that it is forming replaces oxygen, and that preventing the release in the body and of oxygen and eventually causing suffocation at a cellular level. So this stuff, once it gets in, it's not just going to go away in just a few moments. It's kind of going to be hanging around for a while until it can off-gas or you do some, you know, advanced medical treatment like, you know, decompression therapy. I can think back to responding to a call, and I'm going to kind of jump over to the medical side because we run so much, you know, EMS today in the fire service, and we were dispatched, and we ran to this call. Of course, we were running off of an EMS rig, and it was the flu-like symptoms. It's in February. We respond to this call. We get there, and, of course, lo and behold, what do we find? You know, a victim that has flu-like symptoms. Well, she began saying, you know, I've not been feeling well, but my sister is really sick, and she's upstairs. So at this point in time, there's two of us on a crew. We split to do, you know, a quick evaluation. I get upstairs, and this lady is super, super sick. She's, you know, got an altered mental status. You know, she's throwing up. She's, you know, very tachycardic, which would go along with all these signs and symptoms of flu. You know, she's complaining of this headache. She's been feeling bad for a couple of days. Well, all this relates from mild to medium exposure of carbon monoxide. Well, as we got in there, I began getting a headache, you know, very quickly. And at that point in time, I began thinking, you know, something's wrong. This is not right. Well, you know, trying to take care of her because she was extremely ill, trying to, you know, do like a major, you know, rescue by yourself down steps, you know, with a fairly good-sized female, trying to yell for your partner, and he's down there at this point in time with the other victim throwing up. And, you know, at this point in time, some confusion is beginning to set in. And, you know, we're calling on the radio. I called for a full alarm assignment. We're trying to get them outside. And what happened was the lady upstairs did have the flu, but it was compounded because she was going to be taken to the doctor. The sister went downstairs, started in the garage, the vehicle, and left the doors closed, and all that was pumping upstairs. And, again, we ran into this point. You know, we were up into you know, high levels of carbon monoxide, which was causing us some severe problems. And we had reached the IDLH atmosphere, you know, at about 15, I think it was 1575 is what we were at for that. And, you know, thinking about this, 1600 is death within an hour.
Right.
So as this was building, you know, we were probably going to reach, you know, higher levels very quickly. So, you know, we were running a simple medical call, and we found ourselves in some severe trouble. And, you know, fortunately, we were able to get them outside. You know, it did have, you know, the fact that we ended up having a visit to the ER as responders, but we ran a very simple call. So the effects of this is very detrimental. So there's two cases that we can give our listeners, that one on the medical side for a routine medical response, another one responding for a routine alarm, that we ran into this carbon monoxide problem. So when your companies are going out, what are they following for a protocol? What's your typical protocol for a response to CO alarm?
Well, I have to tell you first, Mr. Klein, that was a very good catch, because you could have stood there long enough to become gravely ill just trying to figure out and get yourself and those people from their flu symptoms. Our typical protocol, we have a carbon monoxide investigation form that we created, and the first thing we do is we take a reading outside with our multi-gas detector, and then we go just inside the front door. Of course, primary to that, we make sure that the family is all out and that EMS is en route, because we are a rescue provider but not a ALS or advanced life support provider. So we need to make sure that we have EMS en route at that point. And then if we have 9 parts per million within the house, anything over 9 parts per million, we're going to call the energy company and have them come out and take a monitor it and find out what's going on. And between 9 parts per million and 200 parts per million, we need to do our investigation and be out of that complex within 30 minutes if we don't have our SCBA. If we have anything over 200 parts per million, we need to use our SCBA to complete our investigation there. And then we have a list of questions as to different things, such as their symptoms, what type of equipment's been used, anything different. And they're all listed on the form. And take readings on all levels of the homes and try to find the culprit in this matter. And the fact is, going back to that first scenario that I told you about, when we did our search, here's what happened, was that they had their roof reshingled in the summertime, and this is the first time they had turned their furnace on. So when they had their roof reshingled, the people that had been up on the roof had manipulated the vent and the vent was slipped over to the side, and this was dumping purely out of the furnace directly into the furnace room of this townhome. And so that's a caution that people need to take when they do have work that's done on their roof. Or one of the questions that we've come to ask when we are asking the homeowners about anything that they think could potentially be causing this, we find out if they've had any recent work done either on their roof, or most people would ask, well, have you had your furnace cleaned or fixed or this or that? If they had work over the summer on their roof, they may have had a problem from that as well.
Well, you know, that those are common problems, especially when you have or don't have somebody service your furnace. But if you do have work on the furnace, there's a problem. Talking about you starting in the front yard, that's called getting a zero baseline, basically.
Yep.
For our listeners, and going in, you're looking at anything over 9 parts per million, as you begin calling. As a former chief, in responding to, you know, these types of incidents and creating operating guidelines, we use that 9 parts per million as well. One of the things that you were talking about is the time period that you could stay inside. I took a very aggressive approach to this, and any time that we reached above 35 parts per million of CO, we required our personnel to go into SCBA. And part of the reason that I did that is based upon the time-weighted average for CO of off of the OSHA standards. That was a fairly aggressive approach that I did took. But one of the things I looked at was that, you know, cumulative over time, you know, if we were going back and forth in there, if we did have a 30-minute exposure, you know, we had the ability to do this. And what you are doing or not is not wrong by any means. I just took a very aggressive approach of saying, let's put you in SCBA. Let's make sure. And part of our response to this investigation was full turnout gear and SCBA on their backs just to go investigate. So if they hit this level, it was instantaneous being able to jump into their personal protective equipment and being aggressive and trying not to, you know, get into those atmospheres. But, you know, those investigations, you know, we run into a lot of carbon monoxide issues to where 9 parts per million is relatively common or even more than that.
Sure, and it depends on their type of heating and the style and age of the home, and it doesn't only mean old homes. New homes with their tight seals and things, as we know, provide a difficult for your house to breathe, so quite often we'll find higher CO readings in those. And Chief, you're absolutely right. Aggressive approach is the way to take this, because it's not like we need to save our air. This is not an air management type of situation where we're worried about getting trapped inside and things like that. We need to take care of ourselves from the get-go. And the fact is that we have the resources, and there's no reason we shouldn't be using them. When we go on these calls, be looking for this type of thing and go in with the expectation that you are in an IDLH atmosphere until proven otherwise.
And I couldn't agree more. We're hitting this on the head. I want to kind of change gears just a little bit, because we are talking about CO and the fact that it is wintertime. This is a cold weather response. But we also have to think our structure fires go up. What's one of the first things people want to do once they get the fire knocked down? Let's get that SCBA off while they're trying to, you know, do the cleanup work and the overhaul work. Part of what was added into our policies as well is because we know that once we get to that overhaul phase, is that CO is such a prominent gas that's being, you know, emitted into the atmosphere and into some of these closed atmospheres that we could be in during overhauls, that we began doing CO monitoring before we, you know, took off our SCBA. And again, we set a policy that, you know, because of being in that atmosphere and doing ventilation, we wanted to get it down to a minimum of 10 parts per million, and I used 10 because it was close to the 9, with ventilation before we would actually take our SCBA off. A lot of folks didn't like that. They thought that was a super aggressive approach. But also look at the long-term exposure components that CO could have, or the damage it could have, and some of the research studies that are out there that are associated with, you know, our cardiac events that are occurring on fire scenes And, you know, we all know that cardiac arrests are, and cardiac events are the number one killer of firefighters. And they're starting to show some of this relationship between this based upon, you know, the etiology, you know, behind, you know, how the body works, the physiology components behind that, of when you put all this together. Some thoughts that you have on this particular topic.
Well, you brought that out very clearly a little earlier in the cumulative nature of carbon monoxide and how it attacks our hemoglobin and then resists any oxygen from getting into your blood. The fact is that if we don't take that aggressive approach, we're doing overhaul. We're not breathing at a normal walking or a normal sitting type of breathing. We're working, doing overhaul. So we're breathing faster. This is cumulative, as you said. So it needs to off-gas, and it doesn't off-gas at the rate that our oxygen and other things do. So if you had some carbon monoxide from a previous fire and or you're a smoker and other things, you're combining these things, and it's all contributing to a larger CO level in your blood system, which, again, leads directly to what you said, the fact that we're going to have more heart and stress-related injuries in our firefighters if we don't take the proper care of them by being aggressive like that.
You know, and that's important to me. One of the focuses, and I know it is to you based off of your work with the fire and life safety education, I know that you've worked very diligently on firefighter safety as well as, you know, the fire and life safety education of our community. This is something we have to do, and this is something that our firefighters and especially our fire officers need to take serious. And I know that, you know, there's some razzing that goes on out there about, you know, wearing your SCBA and, you know, you need to be the tough guy. But our officers that are on the streets, especially the company-level officers, need to take a very aggressive, hard-approached demeanor on this and say, no, we have to protect you. This is the policy. We're not going to break it. You need to think about the people that are in your life, you know, at home. You need to think about the people you're working around because inadvertently, if a firefighter becomes in trouble, you know, it inherently puts the rest of the group that's on that scene in a higher risk factor. We know that. So I think our officers need to step up, especially at the company level, and be a little hardball on this. And sometimes that doesn't happen, and you know that very well, correct?
Absolutely. The fact is that anybody calls me a cupcake because I'm wearing my SCBA, they're going to find out different. And you know, we need to understand that everything that we do and have done in the past is going to be done differently tomorrow. A lot of people are resistant to change, like you said, because they think it might be considered not manly enough, or not that they're taking over precautions, taking too many precautions. And the fact is each day we learn about new things that are contributing to our early demise in this industry. And if we don't grab the bull by the horns and stop these things, we're going to be have the highest fatality rate or morbidity and mortality rate of any industry out there. And we don't need to. We need to follow what we learn and then act upon that and stop making the same mistakes of the past.
Absolutely. And I don't think that we could bring that out any better at this point. So to our listeners out there, you know, one of the things that I want to echo before we go to a break here is that carbon monoxide is a very serious response, and we need to take it as a serious response. We need to educate our public. It needs to be part of your fire and life safety education, especially as we start going into the cooler months in the fall. At the time period of Fire Prevention Week is an excellent opportunity to introduce this, because that's what we do, you know, every day. There's more than just fire that we need to educate our public on. Our officers and our firefighters need to be aggressive in protecting themselves, and we need to really look at this and realize these are serious responses. We're at a break time. We need to stop and take a break. You're listening to Training and Tactics Talk on radio at firehouse.com.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome back to Training and Tactics Talk. I'm Douglas Klein, your host, and we're talking about cold weather responses. In the first half of the show, we talked about some carbon monoxide responses and the importance of not being complacent and focused on the true potential that carbon monoxide alarms or responses could have. Joining me on the show is Daniel Bernardi. He is a 23-year veteran and has got several big pieces behind his name that I'm very proud of him for. And one that I want to re-mention is the Congressional Fire Service Institute Award for his fire and life safety education efforts. Chief, I know that you spent a lot of time in the fire service and dealing on both sides of the fence with career and volunteer, being involved at the state fire marshal level, working in areas that definitely have some cold weather responses. Being in Minnesota, I know that y'all are coming off of some heavy snow in the last 24 hours that, you know, we're presenting the program today. Myself, growing up in West Virginia, we did have a lot of cold weather during the winter, a lot of snow. And responses and being response ready in the wintertime versus the summertime is different. So let's start off there. What are some of the things that our firefighters and our fire officers really need to know about being response ready when it comes to cold weather and winter months and dealing with icy and snow conditions?
Well, Chief, one of the things that my crews prepare for the winter for is that we obviously run brush rigs, grass fire trucks, wildland rigs, whatever you want to call them, and we need to drain the pumps on those and get all the back cans off of there, but be ready to, because during the drier months, when we haven't had snow but we still have grass fires in the winter, so we have to have them at the ready to be able to get them back on the road again in the wintertime. But we also dump all our pumps and drain everything. All our lines are drained on our trucks, so we have to go through the transition in October each year and have our engineer meetings and make sure that all of the firefighters know that if they were involved in the pumping or drafting of water during the winter operations, that we drain everything out so that we don't have any frozen lines. Obviously, when we're on the scene, which my crews are out right now on the second fire in the last hour, and they keep their nozzles open or cracked a little bit to allow water to continue running so that we don't have frozen lines or frozen nozzles. We make sure that our nozzles and that our, we try to the best we can make ourselves uphill and away from flow, water flow that will cause large icy areas for our work environment and for our crews coming in. Some other things I guess we do have a driving safety seminar before winter starts every year, and like you said, we just had a great deal of snow over the last 24 hours, and I happened to be the first one to the station and jump behind the wheel about 8:30 this morning, and it was more than a little bit slippery out there, and you know, when you're talking about winter driving, we all know that our skills are going to need to change, the things we do, we don't run Jake brakes and things like that. But we also need to pay closer attention to the people next to us and around us. Normally, we're watching more at intersections and things like that. Well, in these conditions, you need to watch everybody next to you. One little loss of traction and that car starts to spin out, and it's going to ruin our day and make our response take away time from our response. So not just with driving, but with pumps and on-scene operations, we need to keep water flowing. We also we have a tanker follow up our engine all winter long in the event that a hydrant didn't have a good seal. We use all dry barrel hydrants, but sometimes they don't get a good seal, and we're not going to know that until we get there and it's frozen shut. So we follow our engines with tankers to be able to set up a drafting operation all winter.
Well, that's definitely some good information for folks that, if nothing else, it's a refresher to them. I want to jump to an area and talk a little bit about fire ground operations when you arrive on scene and you've got icy or snow conditions. I can remember on several occasions of trying to stretch hose lines through, you know, a foot, 2 foot of snow, you know, down a driveway or through a yard to you can get to the front door to where you can try to make entry, and it becomes very difficult. One of the things that I know that you have to do, and as firefighters, we're used to coming off the truck, being able to grab lines and quickly deploy them. In the wintertime, that dynamic changes drastically. We have to take the approach that we're going to slow up a little bit. It's easy to, you know, take a couple of steps, and the next thing you know, you're laying flat on your back. You've hit your head. You knocked your helmet off. You've landed on an SCBA tank. Now you're injured. Part of what we have to do is have what I call controlled, deliberate motion. And in deploying hose lines and dragging hose lines or any of our operations, whether it's, you know, carrying ladders to set up, deploying, you know, hose lines, catching hydrants, any of that type of stuff, or just walking around the fire scene, we have to be very deliberate in our actions, and we need to slow down a little bit. And it also is going to take a lot more energy when you're stretching hose lines and you've got the resistance of snow that you're having to drag this, you know, heavy line through, is that a lot of times you're not going to be able to advance maybe a charged hose line around the side of the house. You may have to set up and do some dry lays, some different tactics than what you normally would do maybe during the summertime or when we don't have inclement conditions, you know, that we're dealing with. So, you know, one case that I do remember is that we had a building behind a house. It was basically a barn, for lack of better terms. It was more used for storage, and it was a significant lay, and we were, you know, outlaying a 2.5 line to be gated off. And as we were stretching down through there, I was in about just a little over knee-deep snow. And I know by the time I got down to where we needed to be with that hose line, I was exhausted. I mean, in deploying it, you know, even trying to drag it and drop it, you know, from our shoulders, wading through the snow took its toll on us because it was, you know, heavy snow, it was wet, and, you know, it does take its toll. Well, speaking of that, now we have to worry about hypothermic conditions upon our firefighters. They're out in the cold, they have exposures, they're going to be wet from nothing more than the elements, potentially, with snow and ice gathering on there, and, you know, even with firefighting, they get wet. One other case that sticks out in my mind was on Super Bowl Sunday. It was back in 1985. I can remember we were still riding tailboards then. And riding when the wind chill factor was 64 below. And we were about 15 below. And, of course, I flipped the swindle sheet up over the bar. We had, you know, the harnesses that held you on. And riding down the road thinking, this is a bad day. Well, by the time we got done with firefighting operations, walked out, that's when we had the buckles on the coats. I could bend at the elbows, bend at the shoulders, and everything else was frozen. I rode back to the station in the cab of another truck, and I still had ice on those buckles to the point that we had to take lighters and actually melt them to get my coat off. So those are the type of conditions you think about getting somebody hypothermic. You know, we can have a lot of conditions, so rehab now plays in. So tell me a little bit about what is going on in Minnesota when we think about all this cold that y'all deal with for a longer period of time, more consistent, than how you take care of your people when they're on scenes like that.
Well, Chief, we do cycle through our people very quickly. Our accountability officer has a timer and will time our crews, and after if you've made an entry, now you're obviously going right to rehab after your entry because of your potential for hypothermia and for overwork and to get yourself refreshed, which is normal summer operations. But in the winter, we add that to every crew, whether you're a ladder crew or a ventilation crew or a sector side that you're just doing observations or hose tending, you're going to be rotated through every 8 to 10 minutes. So we obviously need more resources, more personnel when we're fighting winter fires. And that rehab area is only so big. We have a command vehicle, a rescue and command vehicle, that holds about 8 to 10 people in it at a time. And so it becomes quite a job for that accountability officer to rotate these people through at a rate where he can keep have room for them. And we do things like bringing in buses and other things. We might commandeer a transit bus and use that for our shelter for both if we have, especially if we have apartment fires, obviously, then we're going to be getting a few buses because we're going to need shelter for all the residents as well. But we take up a lot of space ourselves during these cycling type of operations like we do on a winter fire. And another thing that you may not have in West Virginia that we do here is finding the hydrant. We have magnetic detectors that have quite often had to be pulled out because the hydrant's supposed to be right there, but we have 4 feet of snow and we're not able to see it. So we have those nice flags, but on a spring that stick up to get above the snow. But those are, again, altered or broken by kids and other things. And we'll pull up to where a hydrant's supposed to be, and it can take us 3 or 4 minutes to find that hydrant in the snowbank and then shovel it out.
Well, that's definitely an issue that you're going to run into. And fortunately, my days of fighting in fire in West Virginia are long gone. And the great North Carolina atmosphere and climate is much more conducive to me, especially as I began getting a little age. It's much warmer, and if we do see snow, it's generally not going to stick around for a long period of time in the Piedmont of North Carolina especially. But you're right, catching hydrants, finding hydrants. I know that we had 64 inches at one drop in one of our snowstorms up there, and finding hydrants was very difficult simply because we didn't have that one resource you talked about of the detectors, and we didn't put flags on them because we routinely didn't have that level of snow. I mean, a foot or 2 foot of snow you might see. Occasionally, most of the time, it was 6 to 8, 10 inches. You know, and even if it was cumulative over a period of time, most of the time, those hydrants were dug out or kept up, and it was, you know, relatively easy to find.
Yeah, we do programs where we offer when we're next week we'll be up at the store doing the bell ringing, and we'll hand out some winter fire safety information and have people look over the things to be more safe for the holidays. But one of the things we add in there is asking them to care for their hydrant, and we call it adopting a hydrant, and get them to adopt that and take care of it for us while we're between calls, I should say.
Well, that's an excellent idea, and I hope our listeners are paying attention to that. That's a resource that you can tap into, and most of the time the public's very happy to do it because they've got a concern.
And then the scout programs and other folks pick up on that too, and we've got an explorer group, the junior firefighter type group that goes out and takes care of these kind of things for us too. So we try to get our community and the people in it involved in helping us as much as we can, but we let them know that they're helping us to help them and that we're all in this together. And the more information we can get to them and provide them, you mentioned earlier about public education and how important it is. The fact is that anything we respond to, we should be trying to alleviate. So if we respond to water rescue, well, during our open house and during our other presentations in front of the public, we should be talking to them about safety around the water. If we respond to carbon monoxide alarms and to fire alarms, we should be teaching fire prevention and carbon monoxide alarm use and identification and things like that. It is part of our job description, whether it's written in our SOPs for our fire department or not. It is beyond our moral obligation. It is part of our job description.
Well, you're exactly right. And one of the ways that I put this out to people is that it is proactive firefighting. This is the best way to actually fight fire and do the things that we need to do in the scope of what our mission truly is, and that's to protect and to serve our community. And that's generally in just about everyone's mission statement in organizations. But cold weather responses definitely bring us a lot of additional thought process that we should go through. a lot of additional preparation, some safety considerations that we've talked about. As we begin wrapping up here, Chief, is there anything you want to throw in to kind of wrap things up for us a little bit?
Well, you mentioned about hose line manipulation and such, and that we use dry lines a lot more, and that is absolutely true. We try to set a water supply as close to the house as we can under these circumstances so that the individual inch and three-quarter, or even if we rarely will run a two-and-a-half into a structure fire unless we have during the winter, unless we have a very large fire to be knocking down in there. We try to do it all with inch and three-quarter, but get that Y real close to the door so that we don't have long lengths of that dragging through the snow, as you suggested earlier. So our water operations change are, as you pointed out, we work in teams all the time, but we stay together and close together so that more times people have caught me when I was slipping than I've caught others, I'd have to say. But we have to be there to catch our partner, because you slip and fall on that SCBA, and you're now a part of the problem and not part of the solution anymore. So our driving techniques, our water supply techniques, our attack techniques, our rehab techniques, all of them are modified through the winter months, and so that makes a busy fall for us right after Fire Prevention Week, getting ourselves prepared for these type of changes to our operation.
And one of the key things I will throw in here as well as we're wrapping the program up is that these changes require training. And we've got
Absolutely.
To train. We've got to train, we've got to train, and we've got to train. And one of the philosophies that I have is that you don't train till you get it right. You train till you can't get it wrong. And then that means that every time out, we're going to be doing the right things that we're supposed to be doing. Safety is going to be in the forefront. Our proficiency is going to be there. And ultimately, our operations are going to be good for our citizens. We're going to perform at the level that we should be performing at. We're going to be safe in our operations. We're going to know our jobs. And, of course, that ultimately leads to everyone coming home, and that's our goal, is that when
Absolutely.
We roll out the doors, everyone comes back with us.
And, you know, one of my favorite colleagues, Chief Burgum, Deputy Chief on this department, he likes to refer to training and my responsibility in training as he wants to be able to see these firefighters. He wants to be able to videotape it and then select any music that he wants and add it to it. He says you should be able to perform your duties as if you're dancing to a choreographed dance to music. And I think that's kind of a funny analogy that we should know our job so well and be trained so well that you can pick any style of music and add it to it and we'll be with the beat.
Well, I couldn't agree more, and I'm definitely going to get some mileage out of that dancing and choreographing to the music. I've got several programs coming up, and I can guarantee that I'm going to use that in there as well. Well, I hope our listeners have enjoyed the show today. I definitely have enjoyed having, you know, our chief on with us as a guest, and I'm particularly proud of the efforts that he's made and the advancements that have been made in the fire and life safety education world based upon his efforts. And I think that the award he received from the Congressional Fire Service Institute was more than fitting, Chief. You're very well deserving. You've done a great job through the years. You continue to do a great job, and we're extremely proud of that. And I'm very fortunate to have you on the show, and our listeners have, I'm sure, gained a lot of knowledge.
Well, that's very kind of you, Chief. I appreciate the opportunity to help. My belief is that in our lives, we only have one chance to do the best we can for others, and we should take it. Do everything you can to help others in any way you can, every place you can, and that means proactive efforts. And so I appreciate your understanding of that and the kind words and the opportunity to share some winter tactics and some carbon monoxide response things with your listeners, and I hope to get back on and talk with you again soon.
We look forward to that. And we thank our listeners for tuning in to Training and Tactics Talk. I'm your host, Douglas Klein, Training Commander with the High Point North Carolina Fire Department. And we look forward to seeing you on a future show. And if you have any questions, be sure to email them in to radio@firehouse.com. We'll be glad to address those for you and, you know, maybe get you on the show to talk about some of those questions and get some of your philosophies to it. Again, thanks for joining in, and you've been listening to Training and Tactics Talk.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio. We'll be right back.